Hello everyone, welcome back. It is around 9 o'clock in the evening on April 3rd, 2014. It's a very beautiful evening here in Winnipeg. The snow is softly falling and it's actually quite warm. I've just gotten back from dinner with some friends and it seems as though this is the appropriate time to offer the monthly response. It's finally starting to warm up a bit here in Winnipeg, and people are gaining some hope that there will be a summer this year. We've just had the Juno Awards ceremonies here in Winnipeg. That's the Canadian equivalent of the Grammys. And I just live a few blocks from the center where they hold all of these big gatherings. It's also the place where they have the NHL hockey games. As well as most of the major concerts that take place here in Winnipeg. So it's interesting to live this close to that building because on any given day when I'm walking home from work, the street takes on a very different personality. So some days the streets are loaded with hockey fans and other days it's music fans. So one night it might be country and western fans and other nights it might be fans of someone like Leonard Cohen. In fact, one night I actually passed Leonard Cohen when I was on the sidewalk when I was walking home from work. So it's interesting to see the city express all these different personalities. As always, I want to thank everyone who's written in, offering words of appreciation, or those who have sent in questions. There were a number of questions that came in over this last month. I want to thank those of you who have sent in donations, those of you who have ordered Budescence through the website, and as always, I want to thank Marcus Fellows for establishing this website in the first place, and for continuing to post these responses each month. Just a reminder that whatever I offer in this response is simply for your consideration. I never really know what is actually going to manifest in these responses, so if at any point it seems as though I become very challenging of your usual assumptions about life, it is just meant for your consideration. I'm not trying to convince anyone. However, at times I may become very challenging of the usual assumptions that people carry about life. And if for any reason my responses don't seem to be very clear or it seems somewhat confusing, if you're still interested, you might want to look at the two major talks on this website. If you go to the Listen drop box and scroll down to Talks, you'll find the two main talks on this website. One is titled An Overview of Spiritual Awakening, and the other is titled Acknowledging the Moment. And those two talks give the broadest sense of what it is I'm offering here. As I said, a number of people have sent in questions, so we'll get down to that now. A first person has written in to say, "Dear Daryl, first let me express how wonderful I think your books are. Your expression seems to come from a place of authenticity that I really resonate with. That said, I have what I hope will be received as some constructive criticism. You repeatedly assert that things are meaningless or fantasies because there are no forms. Now, even though apparent things are not ultimately findable, they do have an ontology of sorts as processes. My dog is a process, so is my car, my thoughts, my friends, my life. So it seems mere wordplay to suggest that because things are ultimately unfindable as things, they are fantasies. They do have an ontology as a process or a somewhat enduring activity slash pattern. And it is common sense to both of us that these processes are relatively real, otherwise we couldn't have this conversation. And therefore the whole basis of your point, or you making the point in the first place, is undermined. Not to mention that the books would never have been written, the website set up, and the reading of this comment would not be happening. Fantasy seems a wholly inappropriate designation to give this stuff that is the very crucible slash material of life itself. Oh, and just because the words we use to talk about things, be it a body or a mountain or a dog, are just meaningless sounds, which I agree, it doesn't follow that the apparent things, processes, are without meaning. So this person sent in a second email to add to the first, and he says that his comment was based on, my comment was based on your most recent talk. I sometimes get the sense that there is a denigrating or downgrading of our constructions of the world and people and cars and computers and supermarkets and so on. You say things like there are no identifiable things, labels are just meaningless sounds, they are not the truth. All I am saying is that these constructions, although not findable as things, are relatively real as processes and somewhat enduring patterns, and that we probably wouldn't survive for long without making distinctions and telling stories. We just can't ignore or disregard stories and constructions as we try to live our lives. They are the very weft and weave of life. It's possible that I have just misunderstood what you are saying. If so, I apologize. Thanks for your time. All right. This person has gotten the impression that I am saying everything in existence is somehow meaningless and that everything in existence is a fantasy. Now, he starts out by saying he first wanted to express how wonderful he thought my books were. And so in order to respond to this, I think I'll simply read a couple of portions out of my books. I'll pause this and I'll go get one of my books here and read from it. Okay, so I'll read a few passages out of Dismantling the Fantasy. I won't read a whole bunch because I don't really want to bore people with this, but this person says that he's read my books and really relates to them to some degree. So I'd just like to read some portions of this, starting with, people desperately want to describe existence, and historically they speak of matter, energy, consciousness, spirit, oneness, and mystery, but descriptions are merely limited interpretations, all of them. They can never tell us what life actually is. I say there is no matter, energy, consciousness, spirit, oneness, or mystery. This is often misunderstood because people think it's saying there's nothing at all, and that sounds very bleak. To say that life is not mystery, not oneness, not consciousness, not anything, this is not the same as saying there's nothing. It's not pointing to some state of oblivion or bleak emptiness. In fact, it's just the opposite. Try asking a newborn baby whether there is awareness or consciousness. Ask an infant if a world exists. Awareness, consciousness, and world are merely labels taught to us by society long after we leave the womb. For a newborn, there are no things, no definable forms, no labels, no awareness, no body, no mind, and no world. However, this doesn't mean there's nothing. I don't have the impression that a newborn baby is feeling lost and bleak. without ideas of awareness, consciousness, or the many other things of life. An infant is a vital, pulsing event. Lively, sensitive, alert, and highly responsive. There's nothing nihilistic in that. Ideas don't tell us what life is. They don't even focus on life. They focus on abstract notions of division and comparison, dividing life's constantly vibrant movement into false impressions of static form, describing one false form as different from another. So that's one portion I wanted to read, and added to that, I want to read this. One of the difficulties in relating to this is the desire to reach some goal. Most people think they need to reach some understanding or get some particular thing in order to feel complete. It's my experience that a sense of wholeness is not about gaining anything or coming to any understanding. When you watch a cloud, you don't need to make that cloud happen. You don't need it to be something in particular. You don't need to understand it as a world of things. It's simply a beautiful and wondrous expression, sometimes dark and stormy, most times big and bouncy. It's the same with all of life. Everything that has ever occurred has been an indefinable, wondrous expression. It's not and never was a bunch of people doing things. And then lastly, I want to read this couple of paragraphs. It's recorded that an old teacher, I think it was Rinzai, could be heard rising in the morning. There were the sounds of a huge belly laugh, shutters being thrown open, and his shouting over the countryside, "What have you got for me today?" His heart was open to whatever was offered. All of it was a fascinating parade of inexplicable passing situations, some pleasant, some not. But he had no fear of it, because it was an incomprehensible happening, a mysterious magical movement, and it included his own being. So, I read these portions out just basically so that I could ask the question, how could anybody read that stuff and think that I was saying life was meaningless? How could anybody read that stuff and get the impression that just because forms don't actually exist, that I was somehow saying nothing existed? Quite obviously, I wasn't saying that. And quite obviously, I'm not saying existence is meaningless if I'm pointing to a wondrous, magical expression that no one is doing, that no one can define. Basically saying that what actually is cannot be described in any way whatsoever. But that doesn't mean there's nothing. What actually is a wondrous expression, a wondrous eventing that has no particular form. There's no way to say what it actually is. It's not a situation of human beings doing anything. The whole thing has this magical quality of expressing itself. And in the acknowledgement of that, perhaps our hearts will open to the full expression of existence. So that's all I really wanted to respond with to this first question, or rather this first comment. A second person has written in to say, "Hi Daryl, I got Buddhescence on Friday with thanks. It's a little more difficult to read than your other books. I know that you don't have enough time to answer individual emails, but I beg you to nevertheless for an answer, because besides your monthly response, how is it I am to understand the fact of death in your view of form and unform? Everything is dependent on a brain. After death, there is no longer a receiver of signals of awareness. What exists then? I am nearly 70, and the problem of death and what could be after or not burdens me extremely. Have you a short answer coming out of your view? Thanks in advance. So, from this non-dual sensibility, the short answer would be, nothing has ever been born, and nothing is ever dying. A non-dual consideration is a consideration of what has actually been presenting itself throughout your apparent lifetime. So, we all have the sense that something is happening right now, and this happening has apparent forms. Now, if we look at those forms and consider that they are solid and stable, then it seems like something has been born, something has been created in this happening of this moment, a particular thing, and that thing will somehow be lost. So we can look at our own body and get the impression that that's a thing that's being born and will somehow die at some point. However, if we look at our entire life experience, we have the impression that all the forms that we know of are changing. So that if we consider this to any depth, we can't really find an actual stable form. There are appearances of form, but all these forms are changing. Now, there's a number of different ways that we get information. We can acknowledge that these things are changing. So in the immediate moment, it may be that something such as our breath coming and going, that's quite obviously changing. The thoughts moving and shifting, those are quite obviously changing. The moods are quite obviously changing. Our bodies, in the moment, we can feel how the body feels, and how it feels changes from moment to moment. The pulsations, the vibrations, the little bits of pain, the shifting of the body, whether you're feeling generally tired or generally rested, all these things are changing. If we look at something like cars or mountains or buildings, then the sense of their changing doesn't seem so immediate in the moment. However, our entire life experience indicates that they change. So, you know, we've all seen buildings get older over our lifetime. Scientists can tell us that mountain ranges are either still growing or else they're wearing away. The Himalayas are still growing a certain amount each year. And then other mountain ranges are wearing down, and certain mountain ranges that seem to be as dramatic as the Himalayas at one time are now areas of just large hills. So if we start to consider this, notion of change, and we come to realize that everything that we've ever really known of is somehow changing, we can perhaps acknowledge that existence itself, what actually exists, isn't something that has a form. So that if we drop all the storylines that we have about life and we ask ourselves, you know, what am I right now? What is it that's actually existing right now? If we just start with the basics, there is the feeling that something's happening in this moment. So we have this sense of, I am. Even if I don't know anything else, there's the feeling that there is this happening of the moment. And we somehow have the sense that it's what we would call basic being. So we could say, I am. But then the question arises, like, what am I? What am I really right now? What am I really? So we could point to a body, But we know that that body was about 1/8 of an inch long at one point, and then it was a foot long, and then it was 2 feet high, and 3 feet high, and 4 feet high. It looked like it was a baby at one point. Before that, it looked like an embryo. After it looked like a baby, it looked like a child. Then it looked like a teenager. Then it looked like an adult. And now it's looking like whatever it's looking like. And we don't have the feeling that, we don't have the impression that it's not changing. We have the impression that it's going to basically fade away at some point. If we look at the thoughts, if we try to locate certain thoughts, we discover a flow of thoughts. If we try to sit and actually just observe one thought, we can't do it. We close our eyes, we look, we just observe. Can we find some solid and stable thought that just sits there to be observed? No. In fact, if we try looking for a specific thought, we can't really find one. And often, when the attention is turned towards thinking, thinking just disappears totally. Are we a particular mood? No. I mean, the mood we had this morning at breakfast isn't the mood we're in now, and the mood we're in now won't be the mood we're in 12 hours from now. So if we begin to examine what's actually happening, there's the happening of this moment, whether we look at it as just the happening in the immediate situation we're in, or we look at it in the grand scale, the happening of the universe, everything is just some vibrant activity, some vibrant flowing that has no particular form, because every apparent person ultimately walks around saying that everything is changing at some point in their lives. In considering this, perhaps we can come to realize that that's all that has ever existed, a happening that has no particular form. It's not a matter of particular solid things rising up and changing, being born and dying. Instead, it's an ephemeral, lively, dancing, shifting happening of some kind that doesn't have any particular form. If you were to describe what it actually is, you wouldn't say that it has a particular form. If you were to say what existence is, you wouldn't be able to say that it has a particular form, because every apparent form that apparently arises in existence is always changing and eventually fading away. But existence doesn't fade away. The feeling that something's happening doesn't ultimately fade away. At night, even when there is what we call deep sleep and no sense of existing, in the morning when we wake up, there's the feeling that we either slept well or we didn't sleep well. So somehow there was a sense of some continuing, some ongoing sense of presence. And every apparent human being is this. If you ask them ultimately what they are this basic happening that has no particular form. It has ultimately no explanation and no particular form. It doesn't mean that there's nothing happening, but this lively dance, this liveliness expressing itself as what we call the present moment, moving, shifting, dancing, flowing, it doesn't have a particular form. And every so-called person is this unformed, lively, dancing, eventing. Even in the situation of apparent death, at some point, you know, if we look back through the apparent history of humankind, no matter how many times this lively, moving, shifting, dancing, eventing seems to have faded away, it seems to have reasserted itself in some way. So whatever this is, It has no particular form. It doesn't even have the form of existing and not existing. Whatever it is transcends both of those apparent forms. It expresses itself in both of those apparent forms, but it's not non-existing, and it's not existing. It's something that expresses both of those apparent forms. And that's all that ever exists, a totally unexplainable happening that has no particular form. So from this non-dual consideration, it's just the consideration that all of these storylines about form are ultimately not an absolute truth. There's no possible way to describe an absolute truth, because what is doesn't seem to have any lasting form. And so what remains is just this apparent happening of this moment. There's no way of explaining it in terms of birth and death. It is the only thing that has ever existed. It is the only thing that will ever exist. It is the only thing that ever makes itself obvious. And whatever it is, it has no particular form. It can't ultimately be explained. It just is. All right, another person has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, I've been into non-duality for over 17 years now, but somehow cannot integrate these two things. I can accept that if addiction to drugs is supposed to be happening, it will happen as part of this ever-changing flow of existence. However, the problem lies in integrating the recovery from addiction through the effort of an apparent addict, which involves using motivational tools, which involves using motivational tools that imply control to be successful at achieving the desired end. Follow your bliss, as you said in one of your talks, or whatever is happening anyway, will be a disastrous concept for an addict to incorporate in their mind. I speak from experience, as I am struggling with a constant effort to stay off drugs. Moreover, I am studying to be a drug and alcohol counselor, which will lead me to be helping addicts, and I can't be giving them this non-dual perspective. But if I don't, then I'll be a hypocrite, because I do believe in this non-dual sensibility. I have heard many of your talks and understand all, or at least most of what you say, but non-duality has never made a positive difference in my life. I know you may say that it's not supposed to, and that it's only to consider the bigger picture, but I'm quite troubled with this predicament and would be grateful if you would attempt to clear it." So let's just cut right to the bottom line here. From a non-dual perspective, it's saying that there's no way to really explain what's happening in this moment. So that stories about addicts, people becoming addicted and people giving up their addictions, that those stories are ultimately not a truth. Descriptions of forms and descriptions of forms that we call people and descriptions of people causing certain things to happen in existence. From a non-dual perspective, these stories are not true. However, to acknowledge that these stories are not true does not get rid of the apparent happening of the moment, and it doesn't get rid of what we would call people getting addicted to drugs, and it doesn't get rid of what we would call a person quitting an addiction. The acknowledgement is simply that whatever this is, it can't be described, and it's simply expressing itself. So in a way, we would be saying that what seems to be a person becoming addicted is simply this totally unexplainable movement expressing itself, and what we would call a person quitting an addiction is ultimately simply a totally unexplainable happening expressing itself. Now, this person is having difficulty incorporating the storyline with the mystery. So he can acknowledge that the whole thing of addiction is simply the expression of the ever-changing flow of existence. But then on a day-to-day basis, he's dealing with a situation where he's trying to motivate himself, it seems. Well, let's just leave it at he's trying to motivate himself and he's trying to motivate others to quit an addiction. Now, from this non-dual perspective, because everything is simply the spontaneous expression of something that can't ultimately be described, even in the attempts to describe it, it's a very simple thing to acknowledge that nobody simply decides to become an addict. So there is an urge to move towards some addictive substance. There is an urge to enjoy the whatever comes along with that addiction, the pleasures of that addiction. It's also the case that nobody decides to quit an addiction. Instead, there is an urge that arises to quit the addiction. And anyone who has ever been involved with a community dealing with addiction knows that you can only quit the addiction when the urge to quit is stronger than the urge to actually stay with the addiction. So even most people within a community that's dealing with addictions will acknowledge that it's not a matter of simply deciding to quit the addiction. It's a matter of discovering whether or not the urge to quit is strong enough for the quitting to take place. So it's to discover whether the urge to quit is stronger than the urge to continue the addiction. Anyone who's ever tried to quit an addiction has experienced a situation of deciding to quit it and then finding out they can't quit it, and deciding again to quit it, and then finding out that they can't quit it, and deciding again to quit it, and they find out that they can't quit it, and deciding again to quit it, and they find out that they can't quit it. Why? Because the urge to continue with the addiction is still stronger than the urge to quit. However, for many, many people, the urge to quit eventually becomes so strong that it's stronger than the urge to continue, and at that point, the addiction ends. So, the urge to become an addict is not anybody's personal creation, and the urge to quit being an addict is not anybody's personal creation, even within our storylines, even within the fantasies of a person doing things in existence. In this situation of addiction, the urge to become an addict was not something that somebody just decided to have, and the urge to quit is not something that somebody just decided to have, and nobody gets to decide which urge is stronger. However, within the world of stories, and within this apparent situation of individuals dealing with an addiction, there is the possibility, or there is the situation of apparent people exploring the situation of addiction and exploring whether it's possible to quit at any given moment, and exploring just how strong the urge is to quit. It always remains an exploration. It's never the situation that the addict is in total control of quitting. And in fact, the most famous process for quitting, Alcoholics Anonymous, has in its 12-step program, one of the steps is to acknowledge that quitting the addiction is not going to happen unless it has the help of a greater power. So Alcoholics Anonymous already incorporates this notion that an individual is not in total control of this situation, and acknowledges that whatever's going to happen will be happening with the help of a greater power. And it says that greater power is whatever you imagine the greater power of in existence to be, whether it's God or the universe or the flow of nature. So ultimately, there is no contradiction here. There's no difficulty in integrating these two approaches. Ultimately, it's a totally mysterious happening. On a day-to-day basis, it seems like a person who has a situation of addiction. However, even within the story, the fact is that the urge to become an addict was nobody's personal creation, and the urge to quit the addiction is nobody's personal creation, and the addiction will only stop when the urge to quit is stronger than the urge to continue with the addiction, and nobody gets to decide how strong the urge to stop is going to be at any given point. All that remains is the possibility of exploring the situation. If there's an interest in quitting, then explore the possibility of quitting. But as Alcoholics Anonymous point out, the quitting isn't going to take place without the help of the greater power. Now, I sent a quick email to this person expressing what I just said in a shorter few lines. And he wrote back saying, "Hi, Daryl, thanks so much for your reply. Yes, it seems to me that I might not have understood the non-dual perspective in its entirety, but you have pointed out the split in my understanding, or rather my half non-dual perspective and half dual perspective, when I separate the compulsion to use drugs from the compulsion to quit drugs. It's made it much clearer, but I would love to know how this understanding would help me feel more at ease with whatever is the case. Whether it's the case that there is a recovery from addiction, or there is the continued suffering due to not being able to quit the addiction. Maybe you can elaborate on this when you answer my question in your next talk. We'll be grateful for that, and many thanks in advance." So, let's see, how would a non-dual perspective make a person feel more at ease with whatever life presents? First and foremost, is the realization that nothing that occurs is due to the personal efforts of a so-called human being. That human beings don't exist as something separate from the movement of existence, something separate that is influencing the movement of existence. A so-called human being is simply one of the many expressions of a totally unexplainable happening, whether we call it the Great Spirit or the unformed ocean of existence or the Tao, whatever, doesn't really matter. The general sense is that a so-called human being is one of the many apparent expressions of something that can't really be explained in any way whatsoever. And that's just the happening of this moment. So within our usual storylines, we identify certain forms, and then we identify certain forms as being pleasant and certain forms as being unpleasant, and then we start saying, "I want this and I don't want that," and when it doesn't go the way we want it to go, we get the feeling that there's something wrong with existence, and when we find out that we don't have ultimate control, we feel that there's something wrong with us, that we should be able to have some more control. And so the world is just a situation of endless problems. The focus on these stories is just one problem after another. And from the focus on these stories, most people are looking for some practical method to improve their human situation. However, a non-dual perspective is a consideration of our usual assumptions about existence, and it's a challenge to those usual assumptions. And maybe in a considering the challenge that a non-dual perspective puts forward in relation to the general assumptions about existence, it may be discovered that there is no human situation. There is no human being making any improvements. Ultimately, there is simply a totally unexplainable happening expressing itself from its own nature. It's something unexplainable simply spontaneously expressing itself in a way that cannot be described in any way whatsoever, in any true way. We can't say, it cannot be stated what is actually happening here. However, it always feels like something is happening here. So there's this basic feeling that something's happening here. The basic feeling that we would call being or existing. However, there's no way of saying what that actually is, and even the words being and existing don't really describe what this is. It just is, and it expresses itself spontaneously. It's not that a human being is expressing it, and it's not that a human being is influencing it. So-called human beings are merely part of the expression of this. And so it is that we can sit down and realize that we don't create our body, we don't create our brain, we don't create our basic needs, our interests, our concerns, our abilities, and our lack of abilities. We don't create any of that because we are simply an expression of whatever this greater mysterious dance is. Now, to realize that, you have to realize there's nothing wrong with life's expression if it expresses what we call hardship. That's part of the apparent expression. There are also other expressions that we would call joy and ease. But whatever this is, it doesn't have a particular form. So it seems to express itself in opposites, confusion and clarity, joy and sorrow, anxiety and confidence, hardship and ease. That's its natural expression, even though we can't ultimately say what it actually is. These labels point to these various apparent expressions of whatever this is. Everybody's life will have hardship. Now, it may be that one person lives in poverty. It may be that another person apparently has to deal with the hardship of addiction. It may be that you live in a place called Syria, and absolutely everybody in that area is trying to kill you in some way, is trying to move towards your destruction. And even when you run away, there isn't any other country in the world that really wants you. And the only country that's willing to accept you becomes so overcrowded with everybody who's trying to run away, the situation is unbearable. And none of that is anybody's personal creation. So ultimately, to acknowledge this totally unexplainable happening is to acknowledge all of its apparent expressions, and to acknowledge the fact that some of those apparent expressions are something we call difficulty or hardship, and at times great hardship, and what seems to be great struggle. And nobody escapes that. It's nobody's personal doing. It's simply the natural expression of existence. It's no one's shortcoming. Whatever you are, it's not your fault that you are what you are, and it's not to your credit that you are what you are. A storm doesn't have to have the feeling that it could have been better, something better than a storm. And a rose doesn't have to have the feeling that it deserves the credit for being a rose. And a so-called human being may come to realize that they don't deserve the blame for being addicted. And they don't deserve the credit for kicking the addiction. That all of this ultimately is the movement of a greater mysterious dance. And in acknowledging that greater dance, expressing itself, there may be an opening to all of its expression, the joys and the sorrows, the anxiety and the confidence, the happiness and the sadness, so that the focus doesn't go entirely on what seems to be the negative aspects. And it's also the case that the negative aspects aren't anybody's personal creation. They are simply the hard facts of life. Now, I know that may not sound like any great benefit from this non-dual sensibility. I mean, it definitely isn't that you're going to sit in endless bliss. However, compared to the usual situation of thinking that you're somebody in charge, somebody that deserves all the blame for the negative things and all the credit for the positive things, somebody who's frantically searching for control and constantly being frustrated by lack of control, ultimately. We seem, this totally mysterious happening expresses itself in a way that we seem to have a certain amount of control, but everybody knows they don't have ultimate control. A non-dual sensibility is simply saying, none of it is the doing of a human being. We don't create ourselves, so we don't create anything else. We don't create our needs, interests, concerns, urges, activities, abilities, or lack of abilities. All of this is the urgent expression of something that just cannot be explained. And to ultimately acknowledge this greater mysterious dance, it allows a sense of rest. A sense of contentment with what life is offering, not because we've accepted what life is offering, but because we've realized that life will express whatever it's going to express, and we ultimately don't have any say over it. And to see that fact may bring a sense of rest. As Doris Day used to sing, "Que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be." It's the realization that there is no problem. What we've been experiencing all along is the natural expression of existence. There are no mistakes being made. Everything is the expression of a totally unexplainable happening spontaneously expressing itself. There never will be any mistakes. However, to realize that doesn't mean you live in endless bliss. It means whatever this is will express whatever it's going to express. And even though we can't ultimately say it's something called pain or struggle or hardship, the actual happening that we would call pain and struggle and hardship will still be expressing itself, along with the happening that we would call joy and ease and understanding, even though we can't really call it joy and ease and understanding. We have no idea what any of this actually is. It just is what it is. All right, another person has written in saying, "It occurs to me that the creative process is a fascinating place where the indescribable is manifest and even seems conscious of itself, but remains indescribable, unrepeatable, a mystery. Perhaps you might want to talk about your creative experience in the arts, in writing, in recording these talks. What I'm really intrigued with is the fact that one can't decide to convey this, or that one can't decide to convey this or that perspective. In my experience, whatever is expressed whenever and however it wants. I may be writing you now in reference to a non-dual perspective, but there's no telling where that's coming from, where it's going, or if it would find itself into a work of art. No telling how anything can, does, or will relate to another thing. It's simply all spontaneous, yet eloquent after the fact. What's your experience in talking about these matters, for instance?" Now, this person also added a bit more. He wrote in again and he said, "You've talked lots about this unformed urge expressing itself, but not exactly from your perspective as the person who makes these podcasts, or from your tangible experience of Robert Adams, Ruth Denison, Ajahn Sumedho, etc. Even the term, the non-dual perspective, suggests a particular repeatable experience, and these contexts of teachers being listened to by students hoping to understand a particular teaching or way of tackling life, as these teachers define it, a method of six laws to succeed as a producer or whatever, pretends to camouflage the actual vivid experience of life itself, and therefore to camouflage it as..." Hold on a second here. Okay, so these situations of what seem to be teachers giving a teaching to certain students, and the students are hoping to understand a particular way of looking at life, a particular way of approaching life as the teacher defines it, these situations basically camouflage the actual vivid experience of life itself, and camouflages the fact that we're an unprecedented creative phenomenon. So he's wanting my, I guess what you would call my personal perspective on all of this, as someone who's kind of gone through these situations. So in relation to his first point about, you know, what's my experience in presenting this non-dual perspective, basically talking about non-duality. Now, he's pointed out in his own experience of creativity that he doesn't get to decide what's going to be expressed, and he doesn't get to decide where it's expressed or when it's expressed or how it's expressed or how it's all going to relate to anything else. So he's wondering what my experience is about presenting these podcasts. And it's basically the same situation. You know, I have the usual storylines that people have, but I don't believe those storylines. And in fact, I don't really know what those storylines are, because it's just something I was taught to call a storyline. I don't really know what it is, but those apparent storylines present themselves. I just have no belief in them, and I have no particular interest in them, because I'm more interested in the fact that they happen automatically, that there's just the happening of this moment, and everything, every apparent thing in this moment is simply happening spontaneously. It's happening automatically. So I have no idea how it's happening. And ultimately, I have no idea what is happening. But within the world of apparent stories, it seems I'm someone who's compelled to, first of all, have a non-dual sensibility, and secondly, to express a non-dual sensibility. Now, I didn't ask for that. And in fact, in my personal sense of things, within the storyline, the notion of me being a person on a journey through a lifetime, I actively fought against this perspective. I did not want this perspective. But my experience was that the perspective moved in anyway. And then when it presented itself, and there was the realization that, oh, this perspective makes more sense than the last perspective, even then, my sense of it was an uneasiness. I didn't want this perspective. I was thinking, who else is, like, no one's going to want to hear this perspective, and I'm not going to be able to relate to someone who doesn't have this perspective. So where is this all going to leave me? Now, I'm also not someone who's inclined to put himself out in front of a group. I prefer to be in the back. I prefer to be in the middle of the group and not be the one out front being focused on. However, part of the compulsion of this arising of this non-dual perspective and the expression, the urge to express this non-dual sensibility, again, I don't really know what any of this is. But within the storyline, it seems I'm a person who has this urge to express a non-dual sensibility. And for me, this is just no different from a cat meowing or a bird twittering. There's no difference between me apparently expressing what I'm expressing and a cat meowing or a bird twittering. And half the time, I'm feeling like I have nothing more to say about this. A lot of the time when I'm by myself, I find it difficult to remember what exactly is the problem. Like, why do people ask me for this perspective? However, there is this urge. You know, all of this seems to just have arisen. The website was offered, people, you know, once I was expressing this perspective, people were coming and asking for more, and more people came, and then I started getting invitations to go to different parts of the world, and even though my sense of myself within the storylines is that I'm not somebody who wants to spend a lot of time in the general public being out front, being focused on, it's also the case, and so as a result, I don't really accept most of the invitations that I get. However, at the same time, there is an urge in me to share this perspective. I don't know why there's an urge in me to share this perspective. You know, within the world of storylines, it seems like I understand that there are other apparent people who, even though they can't ever have my exact sense of existence, existence will express them with a similar sensibility. So I offer this perspective just as a support to them, because the perspective is already in them. And so for me to express it as clearly as I can, it gives them permission to acknowledge that, yeah, they have a similar expression. They're not alone in the world. Because basically this non-dual perspective is not the common sensibility. So someone who is naturally expressed with this non-dual sensibility will often feel like they're alone. in the midst of society in general. They can't find anybody else that they relate to. Or it's probably more the case that there are very few people that they can relate to. And most of the time, if somebody will listen to this non-dual perspective, that apparent person really doesn't relate to it wholeheartedly. They're just being nice, and they let you have your say. They let you have your say, even though they think you're a bit off when they're by themselves. Now, it does seem like, you know, teachers are offering some kind of set program in order to have this, in order to teach this kind of sensibility, but that's not really the way it works. So in my own case, like, this non-dual sensibility didn't arise with me doing any particular practice. The whole thing has been coming on over an apparent lifetime. So when I was 7 years old and growing up on a farm, there were certain very warm days where I would be standing in a grain field, and the warmth would seem to envelop me, and the whole moment became one big event. It felt like one big happening. And the grain waving in the wind, it just seemed like the whole moment was just a lively happening, a vibrant presence. So, I mean, when I was 7 years old, that didn't really mean much. But then at age 14, I was still having these kinds of experiences from time to time. And so it became a real puzzlement as to what those experiences were in relation to my usual views of life being a bunch of different things. And somehow I felt that I knew what life was about. I knew the names of all these different things. I knew that they were definitely things, something solid that I could hang on to. However, then I would be having these experiences of life being one big moving, shifting, dancing event. And I became curious, like, what is that? Because that feels more real than the other moments when I'm focused on thinking and focused on ideas of things, stable things, and ideas of me in control. When I would have these experiences of life being one big moving, shifting, dancing event, that felt more real. It felt like I really belonged to existence in that moment. I couldn't figure out how or why, but it did feel that way. So then there was an interest in meditation. And I discovered that through my own exploration, if I just paid attention to the sensations of the moment, I could have that big, expansive, moving, shifting, dancing event feeling more often. However, every time the thoughts apparently came back, I was back into my usual confusions and ultimately self-absorption and self-centered, focused on these ideas of judgment and differentiation and wanting and ultimate frustration in the pursuit of forms that seem to be stable, things that seem to be stable, but never seem to be stable. Now, after a certain amount of, you know, in that situation, it was also the case that at a certain point, people were asking me to decide what I wanted to do in life. But when they asked me that question, it didn't seem to make any sense to me, because I was aware that nature created my body and my brain. Nature was ruling how it operated. And I didn't create my needs and my interests. I didn't create my abilities and my lack of abilities. So I wasn't quite sure exactly how I was supposed to be in charge of this and deciding what to do with my life. Anyway, after a certain amount of time, let's see, after about 17 years of exploring meditation on my own, I had the feeling that I needed to go see somebody who maybe knew more about this than me. Although after 17 years of exploring this and having a capacity for what you would call very deep concentration, at that point I had a certain amount of my ego built around the feeling that there probably weren't a lot of other people who had been through this kind of exploration and knew as much as I did. But ultimately, I got connected with Ruth Dennison, and I had the feeling that she knew more about it than me. And in fact, what impressed me most was her invitation to explore the moment. It was in a lot more detail than my exploration. She didn't try to tell me what I was supposed to observe or what I was supposed to get from the observation, but she would invite me to the happening of the moment. And as far as I'm concerned, in my entire lifetime, I've never met anybody with that much skill to invite another apparent person to the happening of the moment, the actual happening of the moment. So I wasn't interested in enlightenment. I'd heard the word, but I had no particular interest in that. For me, this was an exploration of some of these passing mind states and ultimately an exploration of life. By that time, I had read Krishnamurti, and he said if you wanted to learn about life, simply watch it flow and don't stop watching it flow. And that made a lot of sense to me. It meant that it seemed like I could learn from direct experience. So when I went to Ruth Dennison, it was just a continuation of this exploration and learning from direct experience. Ruth wasn't telling me what I was supposed to eventually understand. She was just inviting me to the happening of the moment and getting me to acknowledge what was happening in whatever situation I was in. And from that, there was an apparent learning process that took place. After 9 years with her, I had the feeling that, I really loved her spontaneity and the creative way that she made her invitation to explore the moment. But I knew that it originally had come from an Orthodox tradition, so I wanted to explore the Orthodox tradition. So with Ruth, a couple of the big insights that seemed to arise, one was that thought was never going to arrive anywhere. Thought was just as much part of the flowing parade of existence as anything else, and that there would be no final thought. It was also the case that it became very obvious that thought was something other than whatever it was pointing to. So I became more intrigued by the actual event and not so much the thoughts. The thoughts then became just a portion of the event, but I became more intrigued with the event. It's also the case that I then ran across Robert Adams. Ruth forced me to go see Robert Adams. So with Robert Adams, he approached it from a different way. He approached it from he wasn't interested so much in this exploration. He was more interested in just acknowledging what we were knowing in the moment. So his focus went on acknowledging just the amness of the moment, the isness of the moment. And in my discussions with him, I learned that his sense of the happening of the moment was a vibrant event, and his underlying feeling was that event had no particular form, which matched my sense of it. So then I became a bit intrigued with this enlightenment thing, because Robert Adams had a huge reputation as being enlightened, and it turned out that what he was pointing to was just a very simple acknowledgement of the unformed, unexplainable happening of the moment. But I had an urge to go explore the Orthodox Buddhist approach to all of this, so I ordained as a Buddhist monk under Ajahn Sumedho. And Ajahn Sumedho was also inviting an exploration of life, but it was done within the formal situation of living in a monastery, living according to 227 rules, all of which were meant to support ultimately the exploration of the moment. It was also a meditation tradition, and the ultimate meditation was a simple acknowledgement of whatever was presenting itself in the moment. Now, there I began to consider the Buddhist teaching of rebirth, which was the Buddha's explanation of how it is we mistake the totally unformed happening of the moment. We mistakenly interpret that as a world of forms influencing other forms. So that's called the rebirth teaching. It's called Paticca-samuppada. And within the monastery that I went to, I was able to study that overview of what was happening. Now, that just kind of fleshed out a sense that I already had. However, even with all of these insights, you know, at one point, I was married and living in the San Francisco area, and one night when I was sitting in meditation, I became curious about awareness. I was thinking, well, okay, I have the feeling that I'm aware right now, but where exactly is the awareness in relation to these sensations that I'm aware of? And so I tried to back away from the sensations, and I realized, no, wait a minute, these sensations making themselves obvious, that's what I call awareness. There isn't any separate awareness being aware of the sensations. The sensations are the awareness. That's what we call the awareness. So a sense of the sense of being split from the rest of existence melted away. Then there was just the unformed happening of the moment, the vibrant, pulsing, vibrating dance of the moment. And you know, in my early 20s, I had considered, you know, when people asked me to decide what to do with my life, I couldn't quite figure out how I was going to be ultimately making the decision when I didn't create my needs and I didn't create my interests. I didn't create my abilities and I didn't create my lack of abilities. And ultimately, the decision-making process seemed to be simply acknowledging all of these things that I didn't create, because that's what was going to decide how my life moved. Those needs, interests, concerns, urges, abilities and lack of abilities, that's what was ultimately going to decide what my place in life was going to be. It was easy enough all the way along to acknowledge that life was just a totally moving, shifting, flowing event. Both when I thought about it, you know, when I thought about mountains changing and houses changing and the seasons changing, and when I wasn't thinking, when I was just sitting quietly, there was this pulsing, vibrating, moving, shifting, sounding, silencing, lightening, darkening, twinging, hurting, shifting event. So however I looked at it, everything was just a moving, shifting, flowing event. And then when I was in the monastery, at one point I was living in a teepee in a forest for 2 months. And I was on retreat, and I had a whole bunch of incense with me. So I would light these sticks of incense, and I would just watch the smoke coming up off the incense. And I would ask myself, is it true that everything I know of is changing? So I would think about my ideas. Yes, they're changing. And I would be watching the smoke. And then I would think about my moods, and yes, they were changing. I would consider my moods, and they were changing. So I would, and at the same time, I was watching the smoke. And I would consider my body, and it was changing. And at the same time, I was watching the smoke moving. And then I was considering buildings and their aging and falling apart, and the wooden portions rotting and the bricks crumbling, and the fact that it was all turning to dust, and I was watching the smoke. And then one day I realized, actually, all of this is like the smoke moving. It doesn't have any particular form. But even through all of that, I still had the sense that some underlying sense that I was directing my life. I never really investigated that too much, like in great detail. I had some questions about it, but I never really investigated it full on. So I eventually left the monastery. I felt I'd learned everything I needed to learn. And I returned here to Winnipeg. And then a short while later, I was lying in bed with my girlfriend and reading a book by Ramesh Balsekar. And the book was not easy to understand. It wasn't a very simple expression. But I basically realized that what it was saying was that no one has ever had an experience of directing their life. So I set the book down and I tried to find an actual example of me directing my life. But I realized that whatever I did had been directed by certain needs, certain interests, certain concerns, certain urges that I didn't create. And it became very obvious that I was just as much an expression of existence, an expression of nature as everything else. So in the same way that I didn't think that a bird was directing its career as a bird, I realized I wasn't directing my career as a human being. So there was no set program for me to take. I didn't have this awakening in some deep state of meditation, even though I had gone through very deep states of meditation for many, many years. But it wasn't until I actually gave that up and just considered life in a very simple way that all of this became very obvious. Now, each and every one of these teachers that I went to had a different focus and a different thing that they were expressing. One was inviting an exploration. Another was, in a certain way, another was simply asking us to consider what was actually happening in the moment. And another one was inviting a type of exploration and along with a certain intellectual consideration. All of these presented certain situations and certain apparent situations that gave rise to certain apparent insights, but what could be called the final insight, that was just me reading a book and considering a question or considering a statement, the statement that no one has an experience of directing his or her life. Now, each one of the teachers I went to, they lived what they taught. They were very truly interested in the exploration that they were inviting, the considerations that they were asking us to consider. These were very important things to them. And they lived from their observations. Now, in a way, I could say that each and every one of them were very clear, each and every one of them was very clear in his or her expression, but each and every one of them was expressing something somewhat different. And I know that they weren't deciding what it was they were going to express. That's also part of the expression of this larger dance of existence. Now, in all of these teachers that I went to, they did not, when they talked about what it was they were focusing on, they talked about it with great precision, but they were each focusing on a slightly different aspect of existence. All of them were inviting an exploration, and none of them were telling me what I was supposed to understand or what I was supposed to think. So they simply made the invitation, they offered the opportunity to consider life in a certain way, in a very open way. And they did that with a great deal of apparent skill. And they didn't contradict themselves in any way. It was truly a legitimate exploration that they were inviting. What they were offering was simply for my consideration. No one was trying to force anything on me. Now, this person who has written in to ask about my personal experience and all of this has also made the comment that what he loves about my perspective is that it's the first and only one that he's encountered that acknowledges the uniqueness of itself and every other perspective, and it sees them as phenomena. Now, he says that's very rare in a world of people trying to construct methods, teachings, paths, stages. He feels it's a rare and precious perspective about how rare and precious each and every so-called occurrence really is. And I have run across it, not quite as strongly as I present it, but UG Krishnamurti expressed the uniqueness of each and every apparent form in existence. Robert Adams expressed that uniqueness, saying that each and every person was different and that each and every person had to find his or her own way. And in my own sense of this, it becomes one of the most important aspects, because it's a very easy thing to observe that no two snowflakes are identical, no two leaves are identical, no two trees are identical, no two human beings have the same breath rate, the same heart rate, no two human beings have the same skin composition. Each and every apparent form in this great unformed dance is unique. And just as they are now, just as they are expressed, they are the legitimate expression of whatever this is. They are the natural expression of existence. This great, ultimately unformed dance of this moment expresses itself in an endless range of apparent form, a miraculous parade of passing appearances. Each and every apparent form is unique. Each and every apparent form is the wild and exotic expression of existence. And that goes for each and every human being, just as they are. So, I mean, that's a little bit of, you know, I don't usually focus on my personal story. And I don't know if that's exactly what this person was asking for, but that's all that's coming up in response to this question. So let's see what the next one is. Another person has written in saying, "Hi, Daryl. Thanks for your continuing monthly talks. This isn't so much of a question as maybe a sharing and then a request. I've had some of my deepest realizations watching nature documentaries. Earlier this year, I watched a series where the predator-prey thing was very evident, and there are some long, excruciating deaths in nature. I've become quite aware that life moves the way it does and that we don't influence it so much. I experience existence as a swiftly passing flow, transparent and immaterial, for lack of better words. The images and the sense that life moves regardless of our inclinations left me feeling quite vulnerable, not so much worried about death or about being dead, but about a difficult dying or pain and brutality, great difficulties. These were all concepts and ideas about an imaginary future, but that's what was coming up. And these thoughts indicate some sense of separation, even though the separation I once experienced has diminished quite a bit. The thoughts have subsided, but this was a notably dark period to pass through. I don't think this is a question, really, except maybe to ask whether it's possible not to fear pain and not to fear terror. Next is my request. In Dismantling the Fantasy, you write, "This love is not some cold intellectual understanding, it's an openness of heart." So I should say that I'm making a comment on the Advaita use of the word love. So Robert Adams, in the sessions I went to, would make these comments. He would say, "You are not a body, you are not," or no, he would say, "You are not the body, you are not the mind, there is only love." So in Dismantling the Fantasy, I'm making a comment on this love. "This love is not some cold intellectual understanding, it's an openness of heart. This love is not an aching desire-filled attachment to a person, a possession, an idea, a cause, a career, a practice, or an understanding. This love is not some romantic myth of everyone embracing and singing the same song. Instead, it's a truly sensitive vulnerability to what is. Ideas only go so far. At some point, the heart may open to the totally indefinable, unpredictable, and often unwanted movement that life is. Love is that openness of heart." And this person asks me to speak about this vulnerability and openness a little more. So, his first question, is it possible not to fear pain and not to fear terror? So, my own sense of it is that, I mean, within the world of apparent form, even though we don't know what any of this is ultimately, and that it ultimately doesn't have a particular form, there are apparent forms. And even though they're not ultimately a lasting form, there are forms that appear to us right now. And in that world of form, we have something that we call a survival mechanism. So within the world of apparent form, we have human beings, and human beings have another less concrete form that we would label a survival mechanism. And to fear pain is a very natural aspect of that survival mechanism. If we didn't fear pain, then we would probably put ourselves into all kinds of situations that were very dangerous. So my question would be, why would you want to get to a point where you didn't fear pain to some degree? And the other question was, is it possible not to fear terror? Well, terror is fear. So the question is it possible to not fear fear? The thing is, fear, I mean, that doesn't make any sense, ultimately. Not to, you know, it doesn't seem possible to not fear fear, because if fear arises, fear has to be present. However, that being said, it is possible, or it might be possible, to acknowledge that all of this is the natural expression of existence, and that there's no way around the expressions of existence, because we don't exist ultimately as something separate from the expression of existence. We don't exist as something that's in control of existence expressing itself. And we may come to realize that in the apparent expressions of existence, there will be moments of what we call pain, and there will be moments of what we call fear, and all of that is the full and natural expression of existence. And so to realize that, the heart has to open to that fact. It doesn't really matter if I want to escape the expression of life. I'm not going to escape the expression of life, because there is only the expression of this totally unexplainable happening, expressing itself, and part of its natural expression ultimately is what we might call pain and what we might call fear. Even though we don't ultimately know what it is, whatever this is goes on expressing itself in all of these many apparent expressions. There's no way out of it. Because we don't exist as anything separate from the event that could get out of it, or could ultimately control the expression. Even if, on a day-to-day basis, within the world of apparent form, it seems like we might get the opportunity to explore what life is offering, it ultimately remains an exploration of what life offers and what it doesn't offer. It's not a situation of control where we get to decide ultimately what life is going to offer and what it's not going to offer. Now, I expressed some of this to this person, and he wrote back saying that he writes, "I don't know that it makes sense to ask whether it's possible not to fear pain, because it doesn't really matter what's possible for someone else. Those fears are simply what was happening for me, and the fears were troubling enough that I wanted to imagine a time when I wouldn't have them. I've had those sorts of thoughts before, but I didn't understand why I was having them so strongly this last time, and now, of course, the whole situation has changed. There is greater openness on the heart level. Making an effort to encounter those difficult emotions more directly seemed to help, to let them flash through me instead of flinching or tightening away from them." So he's discovered that to open up to this full expression of existence, even though it may not necessarily be pleasure, it's a lot better than trying to avoid it, or tightening up in the face of it. It may still be a situation where we're compelled to try to avoid it, but there is an opening to the actual feeling of that fear or that pain. And in that, there will be the realization that it really wasn't something that we necessarily had to fear, and that the pain wasn't really unbearable. And that ultimately, even if life expresses itself in this way from time to time, it's no problem. It's part of the natural expression of existence. Now, the Buddha made a very strong statement. He said that even with understanding, life would still present pains, and that when it did present those pains, we would simply have to endure them. He made another statement in which he said that his students, there was only one difference between his students and the average person. The average person experiences the pain of life twice. They first of all experience the pain of life, and then they spend a lot of their time walking around saying, "Why me? Poor me, that this is happening to me. How can I get rid of this? How can I escape this? Why is this happening to me? It's unfair." Whereas his enlightened followers experience the pain of life once. So it didn't mean that, you know, if somebody was trying to burn one of his followers with a flaming piece of wood, that the follower didn't try to get away from that fire or that flame. It just meant that life presents difficulties, presents situations that seem to be great difficulty and filled with a huge amount of pain. And that even if we do try to discover all the ways that we can avoid this, we will ultimately find out that we can't avoid all of it. So no matter how wisely we live, there will still be situations where life presents pains that we cannot escape. And at that point, opening up to the fact that life will eventually present something, that a pain that we can't escape, opening up to that fact and discovering that it's not quite as bad as we imagine, discovering that we can survive that pain, all that's part of the awakening process as well. That's part of where we find freedom, to simply acknowledge that it's natural for life to express certain pains that we can't escape, and we can survive that, we can live with that, it's no problem. And last but not least, someone has written in saying, "Hi Daryl, can you tell me if anyone and everyone can realize your perspective, or could it be just for certain people to realize? Sometimes I feel that it is enough that just someone has your perspective, and other times I feel that I also want it for myself. Many thanks to you and to Conscious TV for the introduction to you. Kind regards." So, within the world of apparent form, no one can have exactly the same sense of existence that someone else has. So, nobody else can actually have my exact sense of existence. However, within the world of apparent form, there will be a great number of people who have a similar sense of existence. And those people who have that similar sense of existence, they don't decide to have that similar sense of existence. It's just the way that nature expresses them. And nature doesn't express everyone in this way. But it doesn't really matter, because this sensibility is only important to certain people. To the vast majority of people, it's not that important. And they have their own sense of existence, which is important. It's not that a non-dual perspective is the one true expression of existence. In fact, the non-dual sensibility, the non-dual sense of everything, is that this is a totally unexplainable happening. It's not actually someone waking up to a non-dual sensibility. In this so-called awakening, all of these interpretations of existence are considered to be false. And what's realized is that whatever this is, whatever this happening, what we call the happening of this moment is, it really isn't anything we can interpret in any way whatsoever. There's no way of saying what it actually is. Within the world of apparent form, this non-dual perspective is just one of the mysterious expressions of whatever this is. It's not the one true expression. It's just one of the many apparent expressions. So this isn't a matter of someone finding the one true sense of existence. That's not important. It's not necessary for you to search for the one true expression of existence. All you have to look for, all you have to acknowledge, is what's the approach that fits you? What's the approach that makes sense to you? And that will naturally unfold. All right, that brings us to the end of the questions. This has gone on quite long already. But if you'll bear with me, I might let this go on for another 10 minutes. I want to wind this up with a particular focus. So for a long time now, I've been asking you to consider the fact that you all have the storyline that when you came out of the womb, you didn't have a story. And you all have the storyline that your mother and father and your school system taught you to call certain parts of the happening of life by certain names. So right now, if you hold what you call your hand up in front of your face, you can look at that and you can say the word hand, hand, or think the word hand. Think the word hand and look at this happening that you call a hand. Now, close your eyes and think the word hand. Think it a number of times and just hear that word being expressed. Now stop saying the word hand. Stop thinking the word hand. And open your eyes and look. Look at this that gets pointed to when you use the word hand. That's not a word. Now you all know that when you came out of the womb, this did not have a name. When this happening of life first presented itself, there was no storyline. We were taught to call it certain things. When it first presented itself, it was an absolutely mysterious happening. So let me ask you, what is this? Look at anything around you and ask yourself, what is this? Now what you're going to discover is that the only response you can have is a sound that you were taught to bark. But nobody arrived with a sound for this. Nobody arrived with a label for this. And if you go to different countries, the labels are different. So we don't really have a label for this. If we look around and we ask ourselves, what is this? This happening of this moment, the feeling that something's happening right now, what is this? We don't have an answer. You know, we normally call this seeing, hearing, touching, all the tactile sensations of the body, tasting, smelling, and thinking. But those are just sounds we were taught to bark. There's no way of really saying what this is. Now, we can look around us and we see a bunch of apparent forms, but actually our entire experience of life indicates that all these forms are changing. Now, with my eyes open, these forms seem relatively stable, even though I know that over a long period of time, anything that's metal will rust away, anything that's wood will rot away. The house that we live in now won't be around forever. If it's neglected, it'll fall apart. If it's abandoned, it will just self-destruct. Or at some point, some human being is going to decide to demolish it and put something up in its place. Everything is ultimately changing. If we close our eyes right now, and I ask, what is it that's actually happening right now? Like, there's the feeling that something's happening. Now, if I ask you what this is, all you can give me in response, intellectually, is a label that you were taught to bark. But here's this happening, even with the eyes closed, it's something that we would call seeing, hearing, touching, like the pulsing, vibrating quality of what we call this body, breath coming and going, heart beating, pulsations, vibrations, warmth, coolness, tightness, looseness. Seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling, and thinking. So now if we acknowledge that these labels don't really have any ultimate meaning, they just point to this happening, what is this? In this moment, what actually is? In this moment, what actually is not a label. The labels point to this. Think to yourself, what is there when there is no thinking? And rest at the end of the question. What is there when there is no thinking? Just rest at the end of the question. Don't call it anything. What is there when there is no thinking? There's no way to say what that is, but it's not nothing. Does it feel as though you're making this happen? Or is it just happening? And with that, we can bring this month's considerations to a close. I hope the next month brings you only good things, but I know it's going to bring you a mixed bag of things. Hopefully spring, wherever spring is springing, hopefully in those parts of the world it is springing very nicely, and whatever's presenting itself in other portions of the world, I hope it's going well. So until next time, goodbye.